Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Everybody, and welcome to the Farm Report, where we talk about the nitty-gritty of agriculture and food production each week. I'm your host, Holly Cederholm, broadcasting live from the Heritage Radio Network in Bushwick, Brooklyn. As you may or may not know by now, I'm the guest host of the show for the winter 2016 season. The lovely Erin Fairbanks can be found on air on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. alongside co-host Jack Inslee on HRN's Week in Review, so make sure you check it out. Today, I've got Craig Deal on the line calling in from Charleston, South Carolina. Craig is the executive chef of Cypress in Charleston and founder of the restaurant's in-house charcuterie program called the Artisan Meat Share, which offers freshly butchered meat, over 80 types of charcuterie, and gourmet sandwiches. Deal is passionate about preserving meat and the requisite skills of the craft from the farm to the butcher. Through a partnership with the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy and Carolina Heritage Farm, he had the opportunity to be the first chef in over 100 years to utilize the rare American guinea hog. He is also a founding member of the Butchers Guild and a two-time James Beard nominee. Chef Craig, welcome to the Farm Report.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I wanted to jump right in and talk a little bit about the Artisan Meat Share, which is a pretty unique part of Cypress. So to date, over 90 types of charcuterie have been prepared, stored, and cured in-house. And I wanted you to tell me a little bit about the evolution of the Artisan Meat Share, maybe starting with your inspiration to what it is today.
Oh, sure thing. So Artisan Meat Share started roughly out of necessity of us buying whole animals and whole beef, and having lots of pieces left over. And waste not, want not is the chef mentality that I have goes. We started curing and salting and preserving and putting it up. Well, we ended up producing so much that we had enough that we needed to turn the room over. And we said, how cool would it be if we had a little underground charcuterie club? Kind of stole the idea from out in San Francisco when Boccoloni was getting started with their charcuterie production through Encanto Restaurant, and figured, well, I think we can do that because we have more than enough product to be able to move. And Artisan Meat Share was born, and four times a year we move 3.5-pound bags of cured and smoked meats to about 100 members. 6 years later, it became a brick-and-mortar location at 33 Spring, and we offer all of those wonderful tasty bits day in, day out in the form of sandwiches, fresh charcuterie, from prosciutto, culatella hams to different spicy salamis and pâtés and Braunschweiger liverwurst.
and the list keeps going.
Yeah. I could go on and on about the different number of items that we produce. But that's kind of how the program got started. And really, in a nutshell, it was all to get better meats on our menu at Cypress. So we didn't set out to make a charcuterie program. We set out to procure and utilize some of the best animals in our region that meant tasty, tasty meat going out the front door to the diners. And they embraced it, and they embraced our charcuterie program really well. And so you have a brick-and-mortar location.
So now, so you started out, like you said, just harvesting the bits that were left over so that you didn't have any waste happening. But so now in this rotating slate of fresh meats and the cured meats and the cooked meats and the smoked meats and the salami and all the stuff that you've got going on, now you must be ordering in whole animals specifically for this. So what, like, what's a little bit of the logistics? Like, walk me through the breakdown. Like, where are these animals coming from? How many? How often? What does that look like?
Okay, so I'll just use today being Thursday. Usually we get our delivery from Keegan Fillion Farms on Thursdays, and not always do we buy the whole animal because not always is it conducive to do so. Our farmers part out bits and pieces as well, so they sell loins, shoulders, bellies, hams, heads, and every week they send out a "this is what we have."
Yeah.
And I always take advantage of that where I'm like, oh, you have two shoulders and you have two loins. I don't necessarily have to always buy the whole pig.
Okay.
But when we need to, we 100% solely do because of all the bits and pieces that we're able to accumulate off of it. We take advantage of power buys on hams. Hey, this week we have 8 hams. You want to sell all of them? Sure. We'll take all of them. Scenario. So it's this great partnership of this is what we have and this is what we're working on and this is where we're going, and we work with the farmer as much as the farmer works with our needs. So it's a unique symbiotic relationship of, you know, we don't want to leave the farmer with a bunch of stuff left over, and in some cases we try to go out of our way to help them move all of their last little bits.
Are there certain products that the folks of Charleston have come to rely on you on? Like, you're like, if we don't have this in-house, there's going to be a riot at our door. Or are there things you just have to convince them, like, that's not available this week, like, try this instead?
Yeah, sometimes we run into those scenarios where, unfortunately, we're out, you know, in the fresh meat world, which right now we are currently out of. Right now, our pork chops, which will be back over there tomorrow because we just got a shipment of loins in today, and we'll be cutting pork chops later on today and tomorrow to get over there to put in the case. But that's one of the fresh things. It seems everybody wants a good pork chop.
Mm-hmm.
And in the form of charcuterie, it seems like we move through a tremendous amount of pate, about 80 to 85 pounds of that every 3 to 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And that's on our, we have a pate melt, so kind of hence pate melt in fun terms. But that's a good mover. We also have a bun mi, which is kind of a classic steam bun, done in the style of a banh mi sandwich, which is really cool. So we have these wonderful little kitschy beverages within the menu. We also have a knuckle sandwich on the menu, which I think is pretty cool.
What is the knuckle sandwich?
That is the, we use the hind leg of pork, the small ham off of the leg, or the sirloin tip or pork knuckle, and we do a ham sandwich with pimento cheese and roasted pickles and mustard.
Mmm, yeah. One of the other interesting things about the meat that you source, besides being from partnerships with farms and obviously trying to utilize all the every last bit of it, you like to source heritage breeds. So as I mentioned in the intro, you had the opportunity to be the first chef in over 100 years to utilize the American Guinea hog, which was listed, I don't know what it was listed at the time when you started using it, but it's now currently listed as threatened by the Livestock Conservancy. They sort of have this, they do like endangered, threatened statuses for the different heritage breeds. So 100 years is kind of a long time between meals. So why now? Like, why did you want to bring this back to the plate? And maybe you could tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it kind of started with, let's see what pigs work best for us and how can we utilize them to the best of our abilities. Certain pigs are best for chops and roasts and things throughout our menu, and other items like the guinea hog, which are, you know, rich red meat, high abundance of fat, are best suited in utilizing our charcuterie program. So that's kind of where we kind of say, this pig's good for this, this pig's good for this. Day in, day out, we use Tamworth variety hog, which we get from Keegan Fillion Farms. We also get Gloucester Old Spot, American Spot Cross from Carolina Heritage. We also get the Guinea Hog from Carolina Heritage. And they're based out of Florence, South Carolina, and they're producing a lot of different heritage breed pigs, which Gray Moore is the gentleman I partnered up with to bring back the guinea hog. He was actually raising them, and Slow Foods approached me about utilizing it, and it was a pig that I actually became fond of at loving, but slowly realized why it was becoming a endangered species.
Yeah, so in terms of like this whole conservation ethic when it comes to food, it's like you have to eat it to save it. And that's true of the heritage seeds, the heirloom seeds, as well as the heritage breed. So why is this pig, why do you think it slowly drifted off our dinner plates?
Well, the crazy conundrum of this pig, and I call it a conundrum because normally a pig would be 75% meat, 25% fat. Off of the whole carcass after you take away the skin and bone. This was a pig that yielded out at full size maturity of about a year old, a 140-pound carcass. 65% of it was fat, and 45% of it was meat. So unless you're really embracing lard and all of the attributes of it, you could buy one guinea hog and one large beef and basically make hot dogs and all these other wonderful things. But the synopsis was, if we didn't fill up fryers, if we didn't make lard for biscuits, if we didn't use the fat to make andouille and other spreadable fatty salamis, this was never going to work out for us. So kind of, I call it the conundrum because it was like, well, okay, we're not selling the meat, we're now selling fat.
Yeah. So, but
general population, I wouldn't say, is really overly into buying huge amounts of fat. But we're trying to change that.
What are some of the things that you think would help change the general population's leaning towards using more fat in their cooking? Do you think it's just a matter of them tasting it and getting familiar with it, or?
Yeah, I think the more reports that we see that cooking with lard is actually from healthy pigs and pasture-raised pigs is better for you than the overly processed canola oils and other items out there, hydrogenated vegetable shortenings and whatnot. I'd much rather use lard, and I think we used to do this, and then we got away from it during the Industrial Revolution, and now chefs are kind of spawning the creative of getting back to using these pigs, having a pork chop that has fat on it that's super moist and super delicious. Basically leading the charge in it. And I'm proud to be a part of that, and hopefully we turn people on to, not only is it better for you, but it tastes really good too.
So what are some of the Tamworth and the Gloucestershire and the American Spot. So why do you think some of these other heritage breeds are maybe more readily accessible to the revival in our cuisine?
Well, we talk about the guinea hog, and the loin on the guinea hog is about the size of the loin on a lamb rack.
Yeah.
So it's a very small muscle group, but it's also covered by 1.5 to 2 inches of fat,
yeah,
which is at the same time the same size as the loin itself that covers it. So when you cut a pork chop, you're looking at it and you're like, okay, well, they have to buy the fat and the meat. Unless I'm going to trim all this fat off, and then I have to find a use for the fat.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas on the Tamworth and the Gloucestershire Old Spot, American Spot Cross, the loins are the same size as what we would generally see if we were shopping in a grocery store, where they are nice, large loins, beautiful big pork chops. The difference is that the meat is really, really rich and red, which is not the other white meat that we've heard pork related to for the past, 30, 40 years now?
Yeah, the pork lobby.
yeah, it is, you look at, you look at this American spot, Gloucestershire Old Spot cross, and when you cut it, it slowly blooms out red. You're like, oh my gosh, it almost looks like beef.
So yeah.
Red.
Yeah. And you found, in working with these farmers, I find it interesting. So you found that while the smaller pig, the guinea hog, is well-suited maybe for some of your charcuterie needs and for your, if you wanted to do any rendering or fat-based products, but why, do you happen to know in the farmer that you're working with, why they're interested in cultivating this animal on their farm? Is it surely for conservation, or do they have an attribute that lends better to the farm environment?
Well, I know that for two reasons. One, Graymore is part of conservation and different, you know, whether it's forestry conservation or his heritage crops and pigs that he's raising for conservation. That's kind of part of his business as well, but at the same time, it was let's see if we can create a pig that everybody loves and desires, that is potentially easy to work with in the restaurant. And if you get these pigs at 7 to 8 months, they're going to weigh 75 to 80 pound carcass size, which is easily accessible for anybody in their kitchen to work with.
Yeah.
And
you can fit it right on your counter.
That was the best size, where it wasn't overly aggressive with fat. But the downside to that was is that I would have had to buy two or three of them at a time
in order to get the volume of meat that you needed.
Exactly. So then you're like, well, if I just buy one big pig and get it all done, I don't have to buy three small pigs that would take three times the amount of time.
And what about the flavor in terms of the Tamworth versus, I mean, the fat probably influence, the fat content is going to influence the flavor to some degree, but what, are you noticing any differences in taste between these breeds?
So the flavor on the guinea hog is absolutely one of the tastiest pigs ever. Now, what we've tried to do at the same time is focus on feed from this farmer, and whether he raises guinea hogs or the Gloucestershire Old Spot, American Spot Cross, or Berkshires or anything else, if we buy three pigs from this farmer, they've all been raised on the same feed and grain source and pasture raised, that they're all going to taste similar.
Yeah.
So what we then do is we have a charcuterie pig that we're able to take bits and pieces from this other hog and put with it, and then use this high-end, super flavorful fat from the guinea hog and introduce into it and get the best of both worlds. So we're utilizing everything left over from these large framed pigs that produce a lot of meat, and we're using this wonderful, luscious fat from the guinea hog and putting it all together and having an outcome of the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
But it really takes 2 to 3 full-size pigs to consume one of these small pigs and really influence all of your charcuterie at the same time. But very slightly would anybody other than a trained palate ever pick up on, oh, that's guinea hog.
Yeah.
Or, oh, that's Old Spot. They'd pick up on, man, this pig is all of these pigs are super flavorful from the feed in which they're given, which is, that's where it starts. It starts with great breed and great feed.
Yeah. And yeah, so it's mostly they're going to know, someone eating it is going to know that it's raised well and that it's worlds above the supermarket pork, but they're not going to be necessarily going to be picking out that this is one variety versus the other.
Correct.
Well, it's interesting that that definitely is a conundrum, that it takes three large pigs to make use of one small pig in your
with
system.
With the amount of fat that it has.
Yeah. So we can see why it's been 100 years between those meals, maybe. And we got to bring back some lard. So we're just about in time for a short station break. When we return, we're going to dig into the upcoming Charleston Wine and Food Festival, which is happening in March. So we'll see you in a few minutes.
I was in a surfing band. Why
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
You're tuned into the Farm Report. Joining us today is Chef Craig Deal, executive chef of Cypress and Artisan Meat Share in Charleston, South Carolina. Just before the break, we were talking a little bit about their charcuterie program and some of the heritage breeds that they utilize. And now we're going to shift gears a little bit. Heritage Radio Network is doing some pre-conference coverage or pre-event coverage of the Charleston Wine and Food Festival, which is going to be held in Charleston in March, the 2nd to the 6th. And we're excited to hear a little bit more about that straight from one of the participants. The event brings together local and guest chefs, wine and beer experts, all with an eye toward celebrating the flavors of the region. And Craig, you're collaborating on a couple of the dinners throughout the event, and I would love to hear more about your perspective on, the event says it features low country cuisine, and so what kind of things are you going to be bringing to the table?
Well, it brings up a lot of fun things that we always look forward to every year. Usually more of the classic Charleston staples being fish, seafood, grits, collards, things of that nature, slow-cooked items, lots of smoked items. One of the events we're doing this year is Feast and Fire on Goat Island, lots of fiery cookery, and utilizing local farmers at the same time. So I can't really narrow it down to what we're cooking because I didn't really create a menu.
Yeah.
But I am extremely excited about, it's an event every year that we always look forward to. We're excited to have this year Jamie Bissonette from Toro Copa in Boston and Toro in New York City with us for our big Cypress dinner that we're doing here on Thursday night, which was, I tried to get him to come down last year and he was in Australia, but this year we're lucky enough to get him. It's Wednesday, March 2nd, and I think that's going to be an unbelievable evening, lots of great food.
A whole few days dedicated to just food and wine sounds like it couldn't end badly. So,
yeah, if you like food, if you like wine, if you like spirits and cocktails, and of course, how could you not love Charleston? The Wine and Food Festival every year is a great way to experience a lot of the city and a lot of the food culture that we have here.
So what are, in leading up to the festival, we're kind of taking, we're looking at some certain questions in particular, like taking a look at how chefs interface with food today and what defines your generation of chefs. So you've been nominated twice for a James Beard Award. So I feel like you might be a good person to tap into. Like what's going on in your generation of chefs and what mark have you been working on leaving in the food world?
Yeah, really, it comes down to food with flavor. Seasoned well, good flavor profiles. One of the big things anymore is really what is American food? It is a melting pot of global influences from all over the globe. We happen to be sitting right here in Charleston where, grits, rice, pork kind of reign supreme.
Yeah.
Along with beans and other heirloom varieties of vegetables have been come to known in this area. Along with, I think everybody's kind of synonymous with other certain ingredients being southern staples, smoked ham, okra, things of that nature. But You know, it's just as exciting, you know, whether you want to call Charleston being the melting pot, but we focus our cuisine on southern varieties with globally inspired cuisine. So it could be some Asian, some Italian, some Korean, you know, German from my background, but just kind of all influencing the menu across the board without it being this, it's southern in your face or American in your face type of cuisine.
So you just alluded to your background as having some German heritage in it. So maybe we could talk a little bit about your influences in cooking, and in particular, I'm interested in your how you got to your craft butcher skills as well.
Sure thing. So I grew up in Danville, Pennsylvania, and I enjoyed cooking. I cooked with my mom growing up and really, really enjoyed it. My grandfather had a 90-acre farm where the family would grow corn and beans and greens and watermelon and cantaloupe. And the whole family participated in not only growing, but harvesting and picking and selling and freezing. And another uncle had a butcher shop, and we would always end up migrating towards the butcher shop for where, you know, our meats and things would come from. But at the same time,
this sounds very wholesome.
The country butcher shop also processed game during game season.
Yeah.
So it was always a, you know, my dad would always kind of take us around the back and say, hey, we got a inside report that somebody shot this really big buck during deer season. Come down and check, you know, I want to show it to you. We're going to go in the back door. So it was kind of the here's where your food comes from at an early age.
Yeah, I mean, up close and personal.
Pictures when we were kids standing in front of deer that my dad had shot, a bear that a family relative had shot, and it kind of migrated towards the butcher shop because that's where these things ended up before you got them back to fill up your freezer.
Yeah.
So it is a very interesting synopsis of where I've come from and where my background of food came from. And I never really thought about it until I was actually running the kitchen here at Cypress. You know, what else would I have done? I can't think of anything else because food was all around me. And it's no reason why I didn't pick the food industry to go into, even though none of my family members are, you know, professional chefs, cooks, anything of that nature. But I will always say Mom was the best cook ever.
So in the kitchen at Cypress, so you started honing in on your butcher skills while you were working there, or how did that come into play?
Yeah, absolutely. I always loved working with meat, you know, which kind of, you know, we would break down deer and stuff in the garage when we didn't take them to the butcher shop. But when I went to college, it was, you know, very, very short butcher skills in the college classrooms. And I always longed for more of that. And when I started working at Magnolia's, occasionally I would go back and help out doing some different butchery work and whatnot. And then one of the butchers left, and I was like, oh, I'll slide in there and do it. And I did that for about 6-7 months, and I loved it. And it's not what you can do with the product that you're cutting, but what can you do with the byproduct of what you've cut, and how can you utilize that? And next thing you know, you're making some of the byproduct taste better than the original intended cut.
Yeah.
And spawns off great creativity.
Yeah, and there's the whole art of whether, like, you know, when you're breaking it down in order to make certain, you have to like pick and choose. Like when you're breaking down the animal, you can have one of this cut in some ways, or two of this cut. Like you can't always get everything that you want out of it. Like there's only I'm trying to think of an example where you're, maybe you have one for me.
So an example would be every side of the pig is identical. So if you split it all the way down the middle, you're always going to have two cuts. Mm. Now, on beef, the hanging tender is removed from the carcass before the carcass is split because it's the only cut on the beef where there is one. Because if it got cut in half, it doesn't necessarily, you'd basically ruin it. You cut half of one in half and half of the other one in half. But it is a symmetrical, you know, every beef has two cheeks, but it only has one tongue. Kind of scenario. It has two loins, two ribeyes, two tenderloins, two hams, and you've done this with the original intended cut for trimming out a ribeye. Now, what do you do with the excess bone and fat that you're not using or roasting? How can you make flavorful things out of it?
Yeah.
You make stocks, and you make you render out the beef fat with garlic and herbs, and you whip it with butter to baste other steaks and stuff that so that beef tenderloin doesn't have to just taste flavorless because there's no fat. You've roasted fat from the rest of the animal
and
made this wonderful compound butter to put on it. And now you're introducing rich roasted beef fat back to it and making it taste unlike a beef tenderloin should. And people are like, why does it taste so different? It's the little things along the way that really make the food that much tastier. And whether it's creativity or whether it's the waste not, want not mentality, we've already paid for it. Now we need to use it and harness its potential. It takes more work to use your byproduct than it does to use just your intended cut. But that's where all the fun is.
Yeah. And it might take more work to use your byproduct, but it's less work than getting more meat off the farm. So it's better, like you said, the waste not want not to bring that back in. So you obviously care a lot about the craft, and that parlays into one of your community roles. You're one of the founding members of the Butchers Guild, which is a community for meat professionals who believe that good meat can change the world as part of their mission. So to have good meat, we've identified that we need good farmers that are raising good breeds on good feed, and we also need these skilled butchers. So how is the Butchers Guild, or maybe in another program, how are we facilitating these future butchers? Because there's so many, we've seen the decline in the United States of slaughterhouses and butchers. Like I know in Maine, where I lived for a number of years, people are driving their pigs or their cows halfway across the state because there's so few slaughterhouses. So that's just endemic of, we've transitioned out of some of these artisanal skills. So how are we facilitating future butchers?
Yeah, it's a dying breed, a dying art. As I mentioned earlier, with the onslaught of the Industrial Revolution, as soon as meat could get fabricated in large quantities and put into a box and put into a refrigerated rail car or in a refrigerated packing truck to get shipped across the United States, those jobs of these small, community butchers started to become obsolete. Even if you look in your grocery store anymore, that butcher has become obsolete because they're even packaging stuff in the little polystyrene styrofoam package plastic wrap containers, and you don't even see somebody back there cutting anymore, which is sad. So where do people go to learn these skills from? And for me, as I mentioned earlier, I just wanted to see better meat get on the plate, on the menu. And in the long run, what it created was it created us to be a better butcher out of economics, because if you can't get those cuts, you're not going to be doing it for long. You'd almost be wasting more and producing more sausage that really doesn't hold the same value as selling a pork chop on a fine dining menu would be, or other creative things. So it was not only creativity, but the art of how can we get this, how can we maximize our profits, and how can we keep the field of butchery alive to where people want to continue to do it. And I guess I've done enough of the butchering on my own that, you know, people look to me as a valued source to educate. How do you get it? How do you do it? And really, I can show it 1,000 times, but the end result is you have to get in there with your hands and get dirty to start that practice yourself. And that's how I learned was, I used YouTube a lot to see what people were cutting, how they were getting these cuts.
Yeah.
And train myself. And because, once again, you know, who do you ask? Who do you get advice from? But I think there is more of a resurgence. There is more, and with the Butcher's Guild at doing the things that they do to help kind of facilitate, here's a group of culinary professionals or butcher professionals that we can network and educate. You know, if you have a question, go ahead and ask, because these are the people that want to see it progress. We want to see these craft trades come back. And in the long run, not only, you know, seeing butchery come back, but the art of better meat, better quality meat, and the utilization of all of it leading to better tasting food products coming from it.
Yeah, I was seeing that you had just done, it looked like on the Butcher's Guild, you had done like a charcuterie masterclass webinar. So that's one way people are, it seems like...
Exactly. So whether you're not able to, it's like kind of like what we're doing right now, where you ask questions and I give advice as to what I would do or how I would do it. And, a lot of the members got to type in, hey, I have a question. I want to see what his response to this would be. What works for me might not work for everyone. But I think the general synopsis of here is a good educational forum for what we're doing and how we do it. And, may spawn off the, I'm interested, I'll try it, and we'll see if we can make a go at it. And, who knows, it may be completely addictive, and next thing you know, you're hooked.
Yeah. Well, we're coming to the close of another episode of The Farm Report. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Craig, it was great to have you on the line today. To find out more about Cypress and the Artisan Meat Share, visit cypresscharleston.com. Hit up Charleston Wine and Food online at charlestonwineandfood.com.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.